You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, guys, super excited to dive into this week's episode. We are going to be speaking with David Sawyer, who recently has released a book called Reset. Now, I want to set the frame. This book is going to serve two purposes for our community. One, I believe this episode will speak directly to that individual, maybe in their 30s, 40s, maybe halfway through their career, that just feels stuck. They don't feel like their future, their career is future proof. They feel like there's this tide of new technology that's kind of overtaking them and they can never catch up to it. What is it like to reclaim control of both your career and, frankly, your destiny? I don't think it is too hyperbolic to say that David has written a roadmap for that process. And then I think the second goal of this episode or the Companion Friday Roundup will be to talk a little bit more explicitly about a UK path to FIDE. So our friend David lives across the pond, currently in Glasgow. What he has done is extracted probably years and years of financial independence content that has been produced over here in the United States. And he's gone through the painstaking effort of trying to translate that to a UK audience. This book is a book that will be universally helpful for anybody. But I think also if you're one of our friends across the pond, you're going to get so much value from both this episode and the book Reset. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I am doing quite well. And yeah, I've been looking forward to this since I read David's book. I don't say this lightly, Jonathan. This was one of my top, if not my very top, financial independence book that I've ever read. I absolutely loved it. I feel like it's the book that if I had the guts to write my own book, that I would have written this. It was just phenomenal. And I actually wanted to read a little bit of praise here that was on page one of the book from the UK blog Monavator, which, as I understand it, is the top personal finance and FI blog in the UK. It said, "Hidden in plain sight within the 300 or so pages of Reset is an elegant synthesis of the latest thinking in financial independence, lifestyle design, and age-old philosophical wisdom, cunningly disguised as a breezy pep talk from your witty mate down the pub." And that is exactly how it read. And I just cannot wait to have this conversation with David. So with that, David, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, guys. That was pretty special.
Well, you are more than welcome. And I would say it's well-deserved. What I think Brad and Monavator were both experiencing was the fact that you were able to put together what essentially is a life optimization strategy. The book is so much more than just a, hey, earn more, save less, invest the difference. It was, how do these little seemingly disparate actions that you take in your life come together to send you to a better place? And that's kind of like where I wanted to start. What was the inspiration to write this? Did you have it together on day one?
Well, I suppose I should start at the beginning. So I grew up in Cheshire in England, and I was a pretty bookish kid. I read a lot. I had a bit of a head start because I grew up in a fairly, not frugal household, but one where there was no extravagant spending. My parents didn't go with the herd all the time. For instance, we didn't have a video recorder when I was growing up in our household, and we didn't have a color TV till I was 10. Bearing in mind, I grew up in the 70s and 80s. So anyway, I went to university, came out of university not having a clue what I wanted to do, and chose, I guess, the least worst career option in my mind, which was journalism. I then soon realized that 60-hour weeks and very little pay weren't a good career option for me, and I wasn't going to fulfill my ambitions. So I crossed the Rubicon at that time into public relations, which in essence is all about writing and telling stories. So I guess I had a bit of a head start in that I've always been a writer, albeit writing a press release is extremely different from writing a book like this one that gets a message across, but also tells a story and makes I guess if you look at financial independence in the round, you know, life insurance, investing, saving your pennies, etc., it can be a little bit boring. And I wanted to create an accessible book for absolutely everybody, not just those who discovered financial independence, but for people who've never heard of it, which is the, you know, the vast majority of people in the US, but certainly in the UK. So I was a PR consultant working for PR consultancies for 17 years, 4 years at a small independent consultancy, and then the last 13 at the world's biggest PR company. And during that time, I worked hard, won lots of awards, got regular pay rises, promotions, increased responsibility, and ended up running the Glasgow office of this global PR firm. And during that time, along came children. Soon, I was earning a lot of money, had a lot of responsibilities, and very little time for myself, and certainly no time to think about, you know, the dreams I'd had as a kid. You know, I wanted to write a book, write War and Peace, travel the world, be an astronaut. And here I was, you know, in a very interesting job, but perhaps not enjoying life as much as I should be. So I left that job and set up on my own. Immediately, my mindset changed and I committed to learning, self-development, and started, I rediscovered reading books, but also blog posts. And I was reading sort of 8 hours of blog posts a day in 2014 when I set up the business. And I was also changing my professional skill set. So I'd been a PR man, and PR was in those days very much about media relations. But as time went on and people started to consume their news and information in different ways, digital skills began to be a lot more important in my job. But I didn't have time to learn these digital skills. I was running a profit center, dealing with HR issues, attending board meetings, keeping the top clients happy, exceeding the numbers, making sure my team was happy so they'd be more productive and we'd earn more money. So when I headed out on my own, I embarked on a crash course in digital. And then I segued into productivity, meaning. And by this time, I was getting all my learning from the US because I felt the thinking in the US was a couple of years ahead of London, then a further couple of years ahead of Glasgow. And bearing in mind, Glasgow is the fourth most populous city in the UK, so not a backwater. But I wanted to be getting the best information in the world to use for my business and my family.
And I think that's what comes through in your story. And you actually stated this in the book. You said, like, the problem globally, 1 in 4 of us hate our jobs, while a further 6 in 10 are not engaged at work. When it comes to people in middle management, their biggest challenge in this hyper-connected world is learning new information, particularly digital, which is revolutionizing their profession, but there's no time to learn, to become the future, not the past, to fit the profile of the organization they work for. They have staff to atrophying skills and decreasing motivations are eating away at their pride. They're trapped in highly paid with commitments coming out of their ear holes. And what's more, there's no way out. I think one of the things that stood out to me in this book is someone that has, like, lived this, seen this, and this is a pain point. I would suspect for the vast majority of our audience that maybe got started with a career thinking the job was one thing, but has found out that it has completely shifted and they're not prepared with the skill set to thrive in this, essentially this new gig world that we live in, this new digital world.
Yeah. I was speaking to your colleague, Zach, and talking about the why of FI. And I listened to episode 38 last night with you two guys chatting about on that topic. And one thing stood out for me, which was you were talking about fairly high salaried professional people earning a lot of money with a lot of disposable income, but a lot of commitments, who are only 2 months away from it all crashing down. And that really struck home with me because I remember back then, you know, I didn't have an emergency fund, which would have given me a bit more control, if you like. I was on a really big salary, but I was almost trapped in that job because of the cleaner, the huge mortgage, the kids' classes, the kids this, that, and the other, and various things that I designed to trap myself in a job that by that time I wasn't enjoying nearly as much as I once had. So it really struck home with me that that person that you'd identified there, which is, to be honest, a lot of professional midlife people, because they don't understand money and how money can contribute, doesn't cause, but can contribute to happiness and gives you freedom and control.
Yeah. And to your point, it can be this downward, insidious type spiral where if you're not happy and you're working so hard and you're making this money and you have all these fixed expenses, then sometimes you're saying, oh, I deserve this or I deserve that. And then the money gets tighter and tighter, right? So, I mean, I've seen that so many times. So yeah, I mean, just creating that little bit of space just makes such a huge psychological difference. And speaking of psychology, I wanted to ask about that point in time. You left this global PR firm to start your own firm around 2014. And it seemed like you had this awakening. You started thinking about your life, what your goals were, writing books, all these things you wanted to do, but the years were slipping away and you had this awakening. I wonder if you could put us back there. What caused that? I mean, most people don't just wake up one day and say, okay, I'm going to read 8 hours of blogs today and have this, you know, self-development thought process. Like, where did that come from?
Well, I think it was setting up the business. I wanted to do it the right way. So I had a 2 or 3 month really intense and intensive period where not only was I obviously doing things like setting up a website, learning how to blog. I mean, I'd been blogging for a year by then, but it was a running blog, which is a bit of a different kettle of fish. But the key thing, I think, was trying to work out what I wanted to achieve as a business and what my business stood for. I was pretty clear on this in that I always want to be a sole operator. So my business was going to be, I mean, essentially I was selling me. I was trying to work out what I stood for. So I asked 15 friends and family what they thought I stood for and eventually decided that my values were trust, integrity, and results. Results is maybe not a value, it's sort of borderline, but I felt that that was key, had been key to my success, and it's what I wanted to do in the future. I wanted results, because there's no use just thinking about things. You have to put things into action. And if you don't see outcomes from that, you're not going to keep taking the actions. So I guess it was a slightly introspective period to get to then be extrovert, i.e. getting the message out there about what I stood for, which is embedded in the website. So that, I guess that started me on, switched my mindset from, right, I've learned everything I can learn at university and then journalism college. Now I'm just going to focus at getting better at one single thing, public relations, and I'll do that through experience, and I'll do that for the rest of my life. I'll go up the ranks and somehow I'll be able to retire at some stage. You know, that was the vague plan. So when I set up my business, I started really thinking about things, and then I was really committed to transforming my practice. And if you're reading 8 hours of blogs a day on you know, blogging, email newsletters, SEO, analytics, all the digital comms mishmash, so that, you know, you're able then to provide a better service to clients, you start, some of these guys are also on a, you know, bloggers are also on a learning journey, if you like. So they'll start recommending other people. And they're all, it's all about time optimization, and, you know, and you start riffing off and going off at complete tangents and discovering whole new areas. So I think the whole setting up on your own actually, and also at that time, you know, podcasting wasn't a big thing back then. Blogging, yes, it'd been around for years, but I don't know, there were maybe a few hundred thousand blog posts being produced a day rather than the 6 million now. LinkedIn Pulse, for instance, that came on stream just as I was starting out, and I was in there at its infancy. So it was actually quite an exciting time to be transforming your skill set. So, and it all worked for me as well. So that gave me the confidence that actually all these rabbit holes, they may not make complete sense at the time, but they will in the future. So it gave me the confidence to go off in different areas. And eventually it starts meshing together.
Hey, Dave, I wanted to ask you real quick. You said in there when I was trying to work out what I stood for, you asked 15 friends to give you a sense of what they felt. I'm sweating just thinking about that process.
Yeah, the problem with feedback is that you get it.
How did you have the guts to do that? Did you make it anonymous? What does that look like? Because, I mean, that could be useful for someone else.
There were a couple of people I did put on the spot. I'd just started running at that time, maybe come to that at some stage, which was quite important in this journey as well. And my running mates, there's particularly one who's a Yorkshireman, very blunt. So I wanted some really truthful on-the-spot answers as well. But mainly it was old friends and it was via email. So they're able to think about their answers. And you're hoping that, obviously the email said, please be honest, but you find that people hold a little bit back, but not my running friends. So I got a good feeling back from them and certain common themes emerged. It's a process I went through in the book as well. I had 10 alpha readers and 10 beta readers who were absolutely invaluable in shaping my book. I find that really useful, asking really good friends for favors, and it's implicit I'll pay the favor back at some point.
I have a couple questions for you. It sounds to me like this trajectory of your reset was really, the inflection point was when you decided to go off into your own and try something new. And there's all sorts of other tertiary projects that are attached to this, but you started your own business, and that was a major catalyst for this change in your life. So what's coming through is that you took action, but I think all of us have at some point in time had the idea, hey, I'd like to try something. But right alongside that thought is this sneaky voice that just tells us you can't. And I only bring that up to say that even in the introduction of your book, you had a section dedicated, can't is spelled won't. And you did a really good job going through some of those internal monologues and then combating that. And I'm curious, could you kind of take us through a few of those? Because I think somebody listening to this, that maybe over the course of listening to several episodes, has had an idea, has thought, you know, it would be really cool if I try this, and maybe at some point I will. But right along with that, every single day, there's that nagging doubt, oh, that worked for them, but it won't work for me because. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, they say when you're writing a book, and you're probably getting the impression now that if I'm doing something, I pretty much obsessively throw everything at it. So I've done a lot of research on writing a book, and they say you've really got to tackle people's objections early on. And financial independence is not an easy path. It really isn't. And there's more to this book than financial independence, but I'm sure you will agree that most of the things in it are either related to financial independence or, you know, now you see how I've presented them, you can see that they could be linked. Because it's all about financial independence, I think, is about efficiency at its core. Anyway, back to the objections. Yeah, I'm too old. So my answer to that would be that lots of people achieve great things in their later years. So the book is packed with US examples as well as UK ones. Colonel Sanders in the 1950s. He was on the dole, i.e. on drawing benefit. Him and his wife got in the car to try and get this business off the ground with his blend of flour and spice blends. And he was rejected 1,009 times before someone said yes. So this is a guy in his 60s who is doing something really, really hard. There's a British sprinter as well called Charles Eugster. who in 2015 took 2 seconds off the world record for the 200 meters in his age category. I mean, he was 95. And as it says in the book, he took up bodybuilding when he was 87 to improve his appearance. You know, the list is endless. There's so many people that achieve things later in life. So if you're middle-aged and you and that's, you know, age 35 to 60, and you think your life is mapped out and that's it, that's you, don't believe that.
What are your thoughts on willpower? So, you know, is the difference between people that make the sort of choice that you made and people that don't just willpower?
No, I don't think willpower is a thing. I think, you know, like, I don't know if you're familiar with Darren Hardy's The Compound Effect. It's all about taking small actions day after day after day until they become habits after a month, and then soon they become routines. So it's just a question of getting up out of bed in the morning, working out what you want to do, and doing it. And if you do something for 10 minutes a day, that soon adds up and you'll feel the benefits in the future. People say to me, you know, you've got the willpower, it's all right for you. That's not true. For instance, if I'm training for a marathon and it's 6 o'clock in the morning and I've got to get the kids up at 6:30, and the only time I can get a run in is going out in the dark with a head torch at 5:45 in the morning for 20 minutes, I'll do it. And it's not because of willpower, it's because I want to achieve a goal. So I don't believe in willpower.
There's so many examples of these little nagging voices, a couple others, I'm too busy, or I don't believe in self-improvement, or I don't have 10,000 hours to master new skills.
Yeah.
People, you can come up with an endless list of reasons to not do something.
Absolutely. I was thinking back myself, back before I started running, for instance, I had a BlackBerry at the time. I didn't have a smartphone, but I was checking it all the time. You know, I was watching TV and I was going to bed earlier than I could have, which sounds like a good thing, but was chopping off the end of my day. And it was because I felt I was really busy at work. I came home, I was really busy at home, and I just wanted to collapse into bed. And when I did have time, because I did have time, because I was watching a bit of TV, checking the BlackBerry, you know, doing unproductive things, I was spending it doing that. So that's maybe 1.5 hours every day where I could have been doing something that would have made me happy. Because the easy thing doesn't make you happy. It gives you immediate pleasure, but it doesn't make you happy in the long run. This is a big thing that people need to understand, the difference between, and Mr. Money Mustache writes brilliantly on it, but the difference between pleasure and happiness. A big theme in the book is the fact that we're all pretty much addicted to smartphones, and it's a real, real problem. And it has been getting worse and worse over the last 5 years. And that's all about instant happiness and feeling like you're in control because you're the master, because you've got this smartphone in your hand and everything is at the click of a button. But your brain is just getting bombarded with these stupid little dopamine hits, when actually what will make you happy is doing harder things that pay dividends in the medium to long term.
And I wanted to ask about those harder things, because it sounds like really your entire life changed in your late 30s. You weren't a runner. You weren't pursuing financial independence. You were just at a regular PR firm. You didn't have your own place. But this running specifically and doing hard things, as I understand it, you ran a 2-hour, 40-minute marathon. I mean, that's astounding for someone who wasn't running at, what did you say, 38, 39 years old?
Yeah.
Like, talk me through doing hard things, I guess running specifically, and like, and how that's benefited your entire life.
Well, running, you know, that's where it really all started for me. It sounds like it was starting the business, and that supercharged everything. And this book wouldn't have happened without that. But where the mindset change really started was discovering running. And again, this is just luck, serendipity, you call it what you will. Three things happened in the middle of 2012, my younger brother got in touch and said, I'd like to do a marathon before I'm 40. And I was 38 and a half at the time. So we're talking, he felt we had a few years. And I said, well, I'm not really interested in running, but I'll do it with you if we can do it somewhere beautiful. So I Googled Britain's most beautiful marathon. It was this place called Keeldewater. So we committed to do that. And actually, we ended up doing our first marathon before that, which was in Edinburgh. But that was the first thing. Second thing, and I talk about using negative motivation as a positive. Second thing was one of my staff challenged me to a game of squash. And we were pretty equally matched in terms of skill. But he wiped the floor with me because he was fit and I wasn't. And I didn't like this. So that was the negative motivation. Third thing, we went on holiday to a place called Centre Parks, which again, I mentioned in the book, which is this place, there's a few of them in the UK. It's sort of a holiday camp for the middle classes. That's how I'd describe it. So I went there and we went with friends, and the friend was doing Couch to 5K, which is a program in the UK. And I went out for a run with her and she said, oh, this is interesting. Yeah, no, you should take up running, Dave. And I said, well, I don't think I'll do that because if I tend to take things up, I get pretty obsessed with them. I really don't have the time. Anyway, I made the time. First time I went out, I couldn't get around the block. I was about 30 pounds overweight. But I wasn't disheartened by this. I knew it'd be quite difficult. And then I did a race with my brother, and he was the runner at the time, but I beat him. And I thought, oh, that's a bit strange. I was, you know, obviously must be okay at this. Then I took up this thing called Park Runs. That's a volunteer-led 5K that happens every Saturday across the UK, every Saturday morning. And there's hundreds of them now. It's a phenomenon in the UK, and you know, it's catching on in Europe. And I got quite into that, the ethos of that. And you know, it just went from there. I joined a running club, which again sort of catapulted my development. And soon, within 2 years, I was the first adopted Scot home at the Berlin Marathon with a time of I know exactly the time, of course. I'm a runner. 2 hours, 43 minutes, 48 seconds.
Approximately.
And then I got injured, and then, you know, I was out for 2 years, and then made a comeback in 2017 and got my 2 hour 40 time. So running has been amazing for me, and it's been like an experimentation ground, just like owning my own business has, because I've been able to test out my worldview. So is this going to work? Is that going to work? What would happen if I ran more slowly but went up hills? What would happen if I did this type of speed work? How about if I changed my diet, got more sleep, blah, blah, blah. So I've been able to use it as an experimentation ground, and that's sort of taken that into other areas of my life as well. And I think it's only through testing and things out. You can read all the books and do all the research you want, but it's only through testing things yourself that it really sticks in your brain. So I've had two places I can experiment because I'm in control of both.
One thing you mentioned that I want to circle back to is, you know, this BlackBerry in your case, and kind of talking about how you had time or you didn't have time. You were busy, but when you really evaluated where your time went, much of it was to something that may have brought pleasure in the short term, but didn't bring any lasting happiness, just kind of always present on your phone. The balance there is the impact of the internet, right? That's the other half of this coin. And there's a portion of your introduction in your book where you're talking about, and you're saying, since I graduated from university in 1995, technological change has revolutionized our daily life. The only thing limiting us is now our imagination. All sorts of communities, ideas, and influences have become available to us at the click of the button. Today, 4.3 billion of the world's 7.6 billion people are in the internet. By 2030, everyone will be. The Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, addressing delegates at the World Economic Forum in Davos, said the pace of change has never been this fast, yet it will never be this slow again. I think that kind of speaks to the point that you just mentioned. A couple examples. It took 75 years for the telephone to reach 50 million users, 13 years for the television, 4 years for the internet, while Angry Birds did it in 35 days, and don't get me started on Fortnite. But you make this profound conclusion. This new hyper-connected world has had profound effects on the world of work, too. There's an online tool for everything, systems, services, and software that once were the domain of large companies and organizations are now available to the one-man band. There's Skype, the cloud, everywhere Wi-Fi and 4G. There's no need for us to be chained to our desk, yet the way we work is still catching up. Flexible working is trumpeted but not implemented. All this change is hard to process. It takes generations, but change will come and you better be ready. I mean, that is the premise for this book, because this is not an anti-technology show. This community has benefited. Personally, I have benefited. Brad, you have benefited from technology. It's incredibly powerful. But as with everything, there's a balancing act. And by fine-tuning it, eliminating the things that are wasting your life and focusing on that 80-20, those force multipliers, you get the best of both worlds. And I think that is what the guiding light for much of this book is. How do we digitally declutter and use the technology the same way that Steve Jobs used his technology, right?
Yeah.
How do we shield ourselves from the worst of it and make our lives better with the best of it? I'd love for you to kind of, like, let's just go straight to the heart of this. When you identified the BlackBerry was at one point sucking your soul, and at the other point, the linchpin of your business, like, how do you take action on that realization?
Well, I think you've got to get your basic working apparatus set up first. I think you need a fast laptop with a long battery life. And if you type anything like me, a keyboard that can withstand really, really serious punishment, which is why I don't have an iMac. You need a fast, up-to-date smartphone with a good camera, able to take high-quality video footage. You need a file storage and synchronization service. So most people use Dropbox. I use Google Drive. You need a linked internet browser and cloud calendar, email. And if it all goes pear-shaped, if you're like 90% of the population in the US who are salaried, you need a functional work IT department. Or if you're freelance or work for yourself, a computer specialist who lives locally. I found when I set up in business, just by taking those steps I've outlined, I was much more efficient. Technology worked for me. I could work anywhere. And that just allowed me to have more time to do the important stuff, which was being creative, developing myself and my business and making money.
Yeah, and I know I personally found that the shared calendar, just something as simple as that, my wife and I have a shared calendar, and that has changed our entire lives. It's so simple, and I cannot believe that we didn't use a Google Calendar 5 years ago, but once you implement it, you never go back. I'm curious, like, digital skills. I know I picked up using Microsoft Excel at my job as an accountant for so many years. And I feel like that's really valuable. I'm curious, like, did you pick up any digital skills or like really go after any in particular that have had a positive impact on you?
Yeah. So I'm terrible with technical stuff, even though I'm in digital communications and there's a lot of good advice on that front in Reset. I've tried to give the advice on the basis of that everyone else is not great at technical stuff too. So for instance, I'm not very good at using Excel spreadsheets. However, you know, when it comes to budgeting, which I think is a very important part of financial independence, I don't use an Excel spreadsheet. Well, I do, but it's a sort of in the background. I use a cloud-based software called Money Dashboard, which is fantastic. I'd recommend to everybody in the UK. So when I'm putting out an email newsletter, I don't do it all myself. I use MailChimp. When I'm putting up a blog post, you know, I use WordPress, which, you know, is very functional, has its issues. But because 30% of the world's websites are built with WordPress, the answer to any question I have is just a Google away. So, you know, I'm a big fan of online tools and apps and extensions and add-ins and add-ons, but I wouldn't know how to build them myself. But I can get the technology working for me, and some developers produced a great interface, and the way it speaks to me is really good, and there's lots of pretty colors, and it just make and the bar charts, and it just makes it easier for me. So you don't have to be technical to make technology work for you. You just need to know your way around and the possibilities that are out there.
Yeah, I think what you said there is like you're willing to tinker. Like I personally identify that. I would say that I'm technologically savvy. Have trouble saying it, but I'm a technologically savvy. I could not code anything. I couldn't develop anything or create it from scratch using code, but I'm more than willing to use it and get an understanding of it. I think what I would appreciate, and probably your audience as well, can you help tie some of the things that you just said to someone that actually is stuck? The future is passing them by, and they don't quite see the threads that make that information that you just gave useful. Why should someone go learn how to set up a cloud drive and a cloud calendar? And just for convenience, like help us, you know, make the case for why learning this skill set actually does future-proof their career.
Well, there's like a 25-step program for future-proofing your career. The things we've just talked about are making your day-to-day life easier. The 25-step program is about, it's a sort of program where you start off and no one knows about you. You just work in your office and you have no external profile. And it takes you through a process whereby over time, by putting you back into it, learning some new skills, getting you and your worldview out there, you can build an audience that is interested in what you say. You can make yourself more valuable, or certainly your employer won't want to lose you as much. If someone Googles your name, they won't find an old MySpace page. They'll see you speaking on in a newspaper or a respected platform, and they'll be able to build up a level of trust about what you do and what you stand for. So yeah, I think it goes back to the DIY ethos of financial independence. I don't want to be too dependent on anything or anyone. And I think if your idea of life is that you're going to stay in one job, climb that greasy pole in your niche specialism, and by the way, speaking from personal experience, niche specialisms can soon go out of date because career niches change, and particularly due to technology. If you're happy with that, that's fine. But bear in mind that any manner of bad things can happen. You could be sacked, could be made redundant. Someone could maneuver you out of your role. Your organization could go bust. And that you're probably more at risk in a big corporate organization than a small one. The organization could close its office and ask you to move. Your organization could merge with another organization and perhaps your face doesn't fit anymore. Or something could happen in your personal life that means you need to change jobs. So being dependent on one salary or even two salaries, it's a risky place to be. The process that I'm outlining in my book is all about learning a new set of skills to raise your profile, and those skills are digital skills. Learn those skills and you'll be much more valuable as a potential member of staff for another employer. And in addition, you'll be much more valuable in your current job because they'll know that they could lose you.
And what you mentioned there is risk. And I love you actually coined this phrase, the FU profile, family friendly show. It's Freedom Unlimited. But I think there's a contrast there to FU money in that what we're talking about is what actions can we take now that protects us against all of the uncertainty baked into just a steady job. And I love how in your book, you kind of describe these essentially four pillars of building this profile. Share with our audience, like what's the play here for de-risking the scenario that you laid out above?
Yeah, I like a good pillar too. First of all, if you follow these steps, if you go digital, And by the way, you know, going digital would not make its way into most personal finance stroke financial independence books. And if you're salaried, you don't need to do this. You don't. But it will mark you out from the crowd. And it's a fantastic experience. As someone who's, well, a fairly recent blog, I set up a running blog initially in 2012. It's opened up a whole new world of possibilities for me and indirectly led me to writing a book, which has been a life-changing experience. So I'd highly recommend it to you. And just because most people won't do this doesn't mean you shouldn't. So it could be your ticket to promotion. So the better you become at your job, the more you can do, the more confident you are in your digital abilities, the more your star will rise and your value to the organization will rise with it. Secondly, it could be your insurance policy. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with zero moments of truth. That's the idea that for someone to buy you or buy your services, they need to have heard about you 8 different times. And a lot of these zero moments of truth are online. So the more of these online reference points you achieve, the more desirable you'll become to employers and the more people will trust you. Third, it could be your, I call it happiness at work pill. If you're one of the 87% of the world's population who dislikes their job or is disengaged, you're taking these steps will make you happier at work. And last of all, and this might really appeal to many people, it could be your escape plan. If you're working in a job and you don't like it and you want to escape, taking these actions over a series of years is as good a medium to long-term exit plan as I can think of.
So someone's listening to this. They've decided, yes, I not only want FU money, but I want to build this FU profile. That's exactly what I've been looking for. Help me build this roadmap. You mentioned the 25-point plan, and we kind of started by talking about, hey, do you know how to use a hyperlink? Hey, do you know how to use a Google Calendar? If someone wanted to start implementing a 25-point plan, well, first of all, they can buy your book. They should do that. But second of all, just to give someone a highlight reel of maybe things that they aren't aware of, what does this 25-point plan look like?
Right. First of all, you need to commit or recommit or rediscover reading. And I'd put that in a few categories. So blogs. Blogs are absolutely fantastic sources of learning in that you get an expert's immediate take, fairly unrefined. They haven't had too much time to think about it, but it's not, you know, it's not just thrown together. It's the latest information. The only thing is you have to take the rough with the smooth. People don't just give you something for nothing. So often you'll get some fantastic blog and then they'll be trying to get you to sign up to their newsletter or take up their online course. And that's absolutely fine. But don't be put off by blogs, by that quid pro quo aspect. There's some fantastic up-to-date information in there. Email newsletters, I personally prefer as a source of learning because the content creator, you know, once you get to know the email newsletters in the genre, and the one we're talking about here would be sort of digital marketing, communications, that sort of area, personal development, financial independence. It's more of a personal, cozy, fireside chat, if you like. So I do an email newsletter, and I would say that I'm more honest and open to my email newsletter subscribers who want to be there than I would be in a blog, which is, you know, still all extremely truthful, but it's a little bit once removed. I have a personal relationship with my email subscribers. So signing up to email newsletters that appeal to you is a really fantastic way of supercharging your digital learning. Then last on reading, books. And books, unfortunately, take quite a long time to produce and come out. So that's the negative point. But the positive point is the author has spent it's their best work. It's polished, it's refined. And if I really like a blogger or someone who produces an email newsletter, I'll seek out what books they've written because that's their best stuff. So you need to commit to reading because that is a fantastic way of learning. The next thing you need to have is a system for working out what you are learning. So when I started out, I had a bookmarking system. I used Feedly for the blogs. I stuck important information in my email drafts. But then I discovered the rather non-digital way of learning, which is writing what I learn on index cards. And I always now carry a pack of index cards with a bulldog clip around them, round with me, whatever I'm doing. And I'll write down whatever insight I have, and then I'll place it in the appropriate place. It is a fantastic way of learning that I first heard about through reading Ryan Holiday's blog post. So I'd recommend index cards. Podcasts, like this one, obviously, are a fantastic way of learning, and audiobooks. And this next point is more about when you're at the start of this digital journey, the fact no one's heard of you is an extremely good thing. Because when you actually start producing your own content, no one, literally no one, is listening. And that's the time when you can make mistakes. When you're really successful, you've got thousands of newsletter subscribers, people are expecting something more polished. So when you're starting out, don't worry too much if you've got a spelling mistake in a blog post, or you've got some information wrong, or you've said something that people are critical of. There really is no one listening at that start.
David, I wanted to ask about consuming content. Yeah. So many people, especially in this smartphone age, they just graze, right? They'll get this little hankering, they'll open up their phone and scroll through something, right? But that's not, at least as I'm guessing, that's not the type of learning and really gleaning the expert content that you're talking about. Do you sit down and carve out specific time for this? How do you view this content consumption? Like, do you view it as, okay, this is personal development, I need to sit down for an hour and do this? Or is it part of your day almost a la grazing?
A bit of both. I try to check my emails every few hours, but sometimes fail miserably. So sometimes, you know, something comes in to my inbox. I've flicked into my inbox. I think, well, that sounds interesting, subject line. So I pop onto it and I read, but I know that I've got to get back to some work. So I'm not reading with massive intent. Most of the time, though, every few hours, I look at my inbox and then I'll say, I think, oh, that does sound interesting. And I'll take, you know, whatever, 5 or 10 minutes off to read it. And then I've set up a system that sort of accelerates my learning. So I send out a curated email newsletter every week. And the blog posts that I like, I put in a draft email in my inbox. I just cut and paste it in there. And then when I come to do the email newsletter, I read them again. And then I sort of alert my newsletter subscribers to why this post has particularly resonated with me. So that way, I'm sending a weekly newsletter out and helping people, but also I'm learning myself. If I really like the blog post, I'll print it off, which is a bit old school, I know, and then I'll highlight it. And then I'll take the insights, put them on in index cards, and then put them in the appropriate category in the shoebox or the plastic box, you know, that I've got to store index cards. So a little bit of grazing, but I try to be intentional, and I've set up a system that helps me do that and also helps me produce content.
So I want to like circle back and I want to talk about one of these things. You mentioned starting a blog several times, and I want to kind of push back on that just really to get some feedback from you. Does everyone really need to start a blog? I mean, is that a point you're like you're making? And if so, let's explore that a little bit further, because is the point of starting a blog for everybody to have a Mr. Money Mustache, you know, caliber blog? Is that the goal with this?
I would say that not everyone needs to start a blog. That's the first thing. If you want to follow this plan and increase your profile and learn how to write, explore what you think, connect with other people in your genre, a blog is a fantastic way of doing just that. And for most people, is the thing that supercharges their digital development. So when you set up a blog, you need to learn how to write, format, collect your thoughts, organize your thoughts. You need to learn about search engine optimization, promoting your blog, connecting with others. It's just such a multifaceted and excellent way of getting your head around how the internet can work for you. So if you're committed to using digital to raise your profile, there are many ways you can do it. But as an entry point, I can't think of one better than starting a blog.
Yeah, you know, I find myself agreeing with that more and more, to the point where I could see myself reserving my son's domain name now, just in case he ever wants to use it down the road, just as a way of like, if that's the case now, how much more will that be the case 5, 10, 15 years from now, to the degree that the people that go out and start working on this now, when that is the case, will already be ready. Those domain names will have aged in. It just works to their benefit. This could end up being the ultimate way to show this proof of what, not what a university has said, hey, this is the degree they got, but rather what have you done? What skill set have you cultivated? One other thing that comes to mind that comes through in your book is, and I don't mean this as an insult. There's very few original thoughts in your book, and frankly, in any book that I've read. Rather, a book, as you said, is a very refined way of taking the aggregation of lessons that you've learned with hundreds, maybe not thousands of hours of studying, and refining it down into a story that makes sense. And you're very skillful at weaving that story. I'm curious, would you attribute some of your ability to being able to put this book together to the fact that you were first willing to start a blog?
Yes. If I hadn't started a blog, and I was most active as a blogger in 2014 and maybe 2015 as well. But if I hadn't started a blog, I wouldn't have started an email newsletter. And it's in the email newsletter that I found my, sounds a bit authorly this, so apologies, but that's how I found my writing voice. And I've touched on this before, but I feel like an email newsletter is like a safe space to really organize your thoughts, say what you really think. And, you know, my newsletters now go out to a 4-digit number of people, but it still feels like a cozy fireside chat. And the style of my newsletter runs through into my book. And it was only because I've been doing that newsletter for 2 or 3 years, you know, I felt good about it and I got good feedback. People liked it. That's why I had the confidence to produce a book with quite an sort of esoteric Marmite writing style. And Marmite is, I don't know if you have Bovril in the States.
none of these words.
I feel like we're speaking the same language, but at the same time, I'm unsure.
Right. You have a thing called yeast extract.
Okay.
No?
That I've heard of.
It's sort of this sort of very, very tangy, glutinous, black gloop that you put on toast, right? So Marmite, which is a sort of reverse brand, they market themselves on, well, we're Marmite. You either love us or you hate us. So that's what I mean by a Marmite writing style. Some people love it. Some people don't. But that's what you want, I think, because you don't want to produce a book or write a newsletter that's just a bit, well, a bit meh. You want to affect people. And if you put some people off, that's fine. You're really trying to reach your true fans, if you like, and in my case, try and help people get out of a rut and change their lives and set themselves up with an intentional plan for the rest of their days. So the writing style, I felt, was, you know, really important. And why, you're absolutely right. It's a synthesis, a collection of all sorts of other material, but threaded through with a chronological narrative style that keeps people interested in what could be seen as a set of quite boring or tough to read or a bit deep topics.
So, David, you talked about helping others by writing, but as I understand it from your 25-point plan, there's also you gleaning help from others as well, right? You talk about mentors, you talk about community, you talk about circle of friends. I'd love to hear how you cultivate those type of mentors and this relationship where you're getting help and you're helping others as well, but on a more personal basis.
Yeah, it's really karma when it comes down to it. And I'm a really big believer on that. And it's just being nice, I guess, without expectation of anything in return. And I'm not saying you're doing this just for the good of things and you're going to churn out free content and just keep helping people for the rest of your life. No, there's no such thing as a selfless act. And even war surgeons, you know, surgeons who fly in and operate in war zones, admit, you know, that part of the reason they do it is, yes, to help people, but they're doing it for the buzz as well. But blogging and producing content, just like you guys do, albeit on a larger scale, you'll meet so many people. You guys have developed a phenomenal community over the past few years, just by, at its heart, I'm sure, when you started out, just by wanting to help people and being really passionate about your topic area, i.e. financial independence, and living it as well. So one of the benefits of producing content, so in my case, blogs or newsletters or books, is that you meet all sorts of different people that, you know, I get a couple of messages either on email or LinkedIn every day now from people who've read the book and have got questions or just want to tell me how it affected them or how it resonated. I mean, I was sitting in Berlin before a marathon at my brother-in-law's house, and I got a message from a guy on LinkedIn quite high up in a bank. He was sitting in Centre Parks in Penrith in the Lake District, in the English Lake District, and he was reading about my fictional person, Brendan Fazakerley, who himself was on holiday in the Lake District with his wife and kids. And he sent me this LinkedIn message saying, I'm reading this book in the Lake District at Penrith, and Brendan Fazakerley could be me. You know, so you get some phenomenal things happening when you put your story out there. And I now know scores of people in the financial independence community, and I'm friends with bloggers and people who've written books in the US who previously, you know, were like sort of gods to me. So if you're considering setting up a blog or an email newsletter or even a podcast, and you think, God, that's going to be a lot of hard work, what a faff, and, you know, no one's paying me for it, and oh, am I just going to do this out of the goodness of my heart? Well, there are a lot of side benefits. You'll get much more involved in various communities. You'll meet some people you really respect along the way and may become mentors to you, maybe not official. And you'll also hang on the every word, like I do still, of various bloggers who are mentors to you, but they don't know you exist. And sometimes they're 15 years your junior. It doesn't matter. Because of the beauty of the internet, and we've talked about its flip side, its disbenefits, you know, you can get your learning from anywhere now. You can live anywhere. You can do anything. You can find out all this information that when I was growing up in Northern England in the 1980s, I would have had to put an order in at the local library, and it would have taken 6 weeks for the book to come. The only thing we had was a microfiche. Never mind a ZX Spectrum or a BBC computer.
I think I got the chance to try one of those one time, so I can at least, I know what you're talking about. You know, I think the two halves of the, maybe potentially the same coin, the two strategies, this fake it till you make it idea versus the other half of the coin, the imposter syndrome, both of which I would love for you to comment on, more on the imposter syndrome. Someone saying, I want to talk about my money story, my path to financial independence, my, the synthesis of my life strategy, but I'm not Mr. Money Mustache. I didn't have it all figured out and retire at the, or essentially have the option to retire at the age of 30 years old. What could I possibly offer to the world that would be worth reading? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think it was, I quote it somewhere in the book, Gary Vaynerchuk, who said something along the lines of, everyone, you know, is an unknown until they wrote the piece of content that they became known for. So if you just sit there and do nothing and intimidated by all the people who've written all these amazing blog posts, produced these amazing podcasts, and you could never do anything like that, well, that's a very, very self-limiting belief. Of course, when you start doing something, you're not going to be that great. I mean, I don't know about your guys' first podcasts, but certainly my first running blog posts weren't anything to write home about. But over time, you get better. You develop your style. And if you don't put in those hard miles at the start, well, you're never going to know if you had this talent to write or talent to produce podcasts or talent to do anything. You know, you've got to just get in there, forget about imposter syndrome. It's such a self-limiting belief. Just get on with it. Comparing yourself to others is a road paved with dog turds, in my opinion.
And very illustrative.
Thank you.
And tying into that, though, is kind of what you talked about with being nice, right? And in the book, you talk, as I'm reading it, about scarcity mindset and abundance mindset. It's not a zero-sum game where when one of your colleagues, or you were talking about in PR, where another firm gets something, like, it's not just grumble, grumble, like, oh, they won and we lost. There can be this abundance mindset where A, you can be happy for people, but B, just by being nice and by being a good person, by establishing connections, you can create a network where it's beneficial for everybody. So I thought that was a really important point. I'd love to hear you talk about
it. Yeah. My opinion is we're still behind you guys over here in terms of the mindset that people have in the States, who, you know, people who have an external profile and they're producing content. You know, you should give it all away for free. You should share your best thoughts with the world, not only to help people, but because, well, if you're not being honest and producing valuable information and guidance or showing expertise in your field, well, no one's going to buy your services. But unfortunately, and I think it's, you know, it's a generational thing, and because I'm sure you find this in the States as well, but things are changing a bit quicker over there. But there's still a mindset in business and in people's personal lives as well that you shouldn't give away your secrets because, well, that's giving the competitor an edge. You shouldn't be producing really interesting and actionable blog post because, well, then the person around the corner could go and do it and they could copy what you're doing. Well, you know, I am a great believer in you've got to change that mindset. And if you're good to people, good things will happen to you. And if you produce good material, people will listen and hopefully, you know, eventually your star will rise.
What I love about this financial independence book that you've written is your audience is so focused in this book that you're speaking, you're reaching out to these individuals that are midlife careerists, right? 35 to 60 years old that feel stuck and are trying to unwind potentially 20 plus years of drift. This book, the first 127 pages are about getting unstuck, and it's actionable. There's stuff there that if you feel like, wow, that went sideways and life is just getting away from me, there is an action plan put in place. But on page 127 of your book, like that's when you get to, like after we've talked about future-proofing your career, after we talked about the decluttering process, right? How to get the most out of technology, how to future-proof your career, and then how to declutter both the mental, the digital, and the physical. What we now have achieved is bandwidth. So what I want to do for you now on this episode, I want to go ahead and hop right into our hot seat and tackle that. But what I'd love to happen is if on our Friday show, you would be willing to come back and talk to us about essentially what comes down to a UK path defined, because it looks like you went to painstaking efforts to translate the content that we've been producing over here in the US and make it applicable for people on your side of the pond. So how does that sound? Would you like to join us back on Friday?
I'd be delighted.
Awesome. And with that, are you ready for the hot seat?
As ready as I'll ever be.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, David, question number one, your favorite blog that's not your own.
Well, that's an easy one. That would be Monovator. My entry point to financial independence was Mr. Money Mustache. And then I segued off into all sorts of US resources, mainly blogs, but also books, etc. But it was a recommendation, you know, in the depths of the Mr. Money Mustache forum, that if anyone in the UK was interested in financial independence, Monovator was the person to look at. So if it's good enough for him, it's good enough for me. So off I went across the pond and looked at Monovator's posts and ended up doing the old Monovator gorge, probably to a greater extent than I'd done the Mr. Money Mustache gorge. And I was absolutely flabbergasted when he consented to have a look at an advance review copy of my book. It was even more amazing when he sent me back a quote for the book blurb that made me realize actually what my book was all about. It just encapsulated what it was all about. And I think you'd mentioned that as well, Brad, but when it came back, I nearly fell off my chair. So anyway, Monovator.
All right. Question number two, your favorite article of all time. Now, this can be one that you wrote or someone else's.
Yeah, so it's called Six Harsh Truths That Will Make You a Better Person. And embedded in it is a YouTube video. And if you search for Alec Baldwin, Glengarry, Glen Ross scene, that'll get the particular 7-minute video up. But the basic message was a few, but the one that I took out of it was nobody cares about you but your close friends and family. The world doesn't know you're living. Put up or shut up. Take action. That's it, in essence. And just to say, I came across it through Millennial Revolution's newsletter, and apparently those guys read it or reread it every new year.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. We're definitely going to link that up in the show notes for sure. And David, question number three, your favorite life hack?
Karma. So be nice without expectation of anything in return, because what goes around comes around. And if you apply that to your life, I don't think you can go far wrong.
I absolutely love that. Yeah. I mean, I think the phrase that I use is the abundance mindset of just being a nice, open, happy, healthy person who's looking out for people, trying to connect. And yeah, karma is a much more succinct way of putting it, obviously. So I really like that.
We prefer to use as many words as possible. Succinct is a word that I have not yet looked up. All right. Question number four, your biggest financial mistake.
So I got into investing somewhere in the run-up to, I don't know, it was probably about 97, actually. Which was all fantastic because everything was skyrocketing. And then 1999, 2000 came and I was invested in all sorts of technology funds and stocks that I'd picked from a recommendation out of the Sunday Times. Yeah, that I was that person. One of the particular shares that I had ended up costing me money, but because I never looked at my bank account, I didn't realize this. So the money, it was valueless, but I still had the share certificate and they were still charging me a few pound a month to keep hold of the worthless share certificate. Oh, wow. And that experience back then put me off investing for 15 years because I kept an eye on the stock market and it wasn't going anywhere. And then 2008 came along and then I just never looked at it again. I didn't even realize the stock market was starting to go up again, you know, after a good period, after that period. So yeah, I guess it was getting into investing and investing in tech stocks back way back when.
And it does sound like increasingly you've become a huge fan of index funds. I wonder if those two are somehow tied together.
it's funny. When I did know enough about investing, having got burnt, to realize that, you know, for me, index trackers were going to be the way forward. So when I first got my pension at this big global PR company, and they, you know, financial advisor was there, and I ticked the box. And I ticked the box that said 100% UK index tracker. I guess if I just ticked the box that said, because there weren't many boxes, the one that said 100% US index tracker, I'd be a lot better off now.
With the benefit of hindsight.
Yes.
All right, David, question number five, the advice you would give your younger self.
You know, I don't think I'd change much because like you guys in the US, you very much have a culture of, you know, learning from your mistakes, and you realize that making mistakes can be a good thing because you learn from them. Whereas slightly more in the UK, we are very risk averse and don't like making mistakes and then decide that if we make a mistake, that's the end of the world. Anyway, I don't regret anything I've done. One tweak I'd make maybe in my career, which would have accelerated my development, which, you know, went well anyway, but would have gone a tiny bit faster, would be maybe not to be so worried about what could go wrong, you know, in the early days of my career. And it was a chat by my big boss at the time who sat me down and said, look, Dave, you know, what's the worst that could happen? And if it does, will be here to help you clear up the mess. So don't worry about it. So I think if I'd realized that a bit sooner, but that was maybe 15, 20 years ago.
All right. Now we do have a bonus question for you. What purchase have you made over the past 12 months that has brought the most value to your life?
Well, I'm going to use this opportunity to get a plug in, but it is absolutely true as well. I think it's probably the money I'm spending at the moment on doing my audiobook. The book I produced, Reset, I did it all myself, which is maybe one for another podcast, maybe a writing one. But with the audiobook, I decided, look, the pain involved in learning how to edit and produce, and the fact, you know, I mean, I'm speaking to you here on a 78 pound mic, and the one I'm using at the studio is a 5 grand mic. So the quality is infinitely better, although this is very good. So it's the money I'm investing in doing an audiobook at the moment, which by the time this show airs should be out on the shelves of Audible and Amazon, etc.
Awesome. David Sawyer, people listening to this, they want to connect with you and find a copy of the book. Go ahead and for our audience, give them the name of the book and how to find it and how to get in touch with you.
So it's called Reset. How to Restart Your Life and Get FU Money, the Unconventional Early Retirement Plan for Midlife Careerists Who Want to Be Happy. Yeah, I wasn't going to be satisfied with just one subhead. I needed two. You can find it on Amazon. And if you search for Reset, How to Restart, and a yellow cover with a red dot on it, it'll come up. In the States, it's $2.99 for the Kindle, which is fantastic value, if I do say so myself, and $12.99 for the paperback, which is a far superior product and has an index, etc. If people want to get in touch with me, the best way to do it is to sign up to my newsletter. and then we'll be in email contact and they can ask me anything they want. And if they sign up to the newsletter, they'll get the first 8,000 words of Reset for free. And to sign up to the newsletter, the best way to do that would be to go to reset.me/choosefi, and it's T-O reset rather than the numeral two.
Gotcha. Perfect. And to our audience, if you want to go ahead and place an order for David's book, you can do that at choosefi.com/reset. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes for today's episode as well. David, thank you so much for coming on the show today. This has been fantastic.
I've really enjoyed it. And thanks very much for asking me on. It's an honor.
Brad, when I'm reading a book and I suddenly find myself leaning in, usually it's because that book is speaking to maybe a fear or a pain point that I've seen in myself or I've seen in other people's and I haven't known how to help, what advice to offer. What I loved about Reset and this conversation is that it gives actionable information to that individual that feels stuck. It bridges that divide between the individual that maybe their career has gone sideways or they feel like the future is passing them by, and it gives them those first few steps to take to reinvigorate it.
Yeah, I agree completely. This was a wonderful book. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. And yeah, there are so many, as David said in his book, hundreds of millions of people. It's not just thousands or even millions, hundreds of millions of people who are stuck in their jobs, stuck in their life. And sometimes just having that awakening makes all the difference. And you never know if it's just one podcast, one blog post, or one book. But just to his point, keep consuming content and look for what do you want your life to look like. And yeah, I thought this was a really great summation of it.
If you got value from today's episode, and if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, just take 1 second and press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. It just lets the providers know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. If you want to support us in what we're doing here at ChooseFI, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. To do that, just go to choosefi.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to choosefi.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free and just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 100. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth one life hack at a time.